It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert. This week on Central Time, we're talking with the candidates in a variety of races who are facing primary elections next week. And today, we're talking with the candidates seeking Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District seat. Earlier in the show, we spoke with incumbent Gwen Moore and her Democratic primary challenger, Gary George. And in a few moments, we'll hear from Republican Dan Sebring. His opponent, David King, was scheduled to talk with us in this time slot, but had to attend to a family matter today and is not able to join us.
We turn now to a reporter in Milwaukee, Chuck Kornbach, to tell us a little more about the district and the race and how it's shaping up so far. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good afternoon.
Well, we just heard from the Democratic candidates in the race, Gary George and incumbent Gwen Moore. Are people seeing Gary George as a big primary threat to the incumbent?
Well, by most measurements, Gwen Moore has a better network than Gary George does in terms of volunteers and supporters. There has been no huge desertion from Gwen Moore by the more progressive Democrats who tend to vote more often in primaries. Gary George has been out doing interviews, is up very much on the issues, as you just heard, as is Representative Moore. But again, George's efforts seem to be more at an individual basis, and he's not doing a lot of spending on television. He's doing YouTube ads and so on. Unless that changes in the next week or so, Moore just has the broader incumbent support, it seems.
Then on the Republican side, we've got Dan Sebring, who's made a few runs against Gwen Moore in the past, against David King. He's run for office before, not for this one, though. For making it through the Republican primary, does this give Dan Sebring a leg up with maybe a little more name recognition?
Well, you might think so. I mean, as you say, he was the candidate in the fall of 2010 against Gwen Moore, and also in the fall of 2012 against Gwen Moore. So if Republican voters in the 4th, there are some, but perhaps not many, would decide that they want to keep the momentum going for Mr. Sebring, they will return him as their nominee for November. If they want to try someone new, at least in this category, David King, who's a minister in Milwaukee, would be their choice. But Sebring, again, has the bigger name recognition, having been on the ballot twice.
This is, I think, widely viewed as a safe Democratic seat. How tall an order is it for a Republican to come out ahead in November?
Well, 2010, Gwen Moore in November accumulated 143,000 votes, Dan Sebring 61,000. In 2012, with President Obama on the ballot, she picked up 235,000 votes to Sebring's 81,000. Now, if you think 2010 might be more like 2014 in terms of turnout, the numbers, the gap would still be about 2.5 times. Now, Sebring will argue, probably shortly with you, that Representative Moore has not done the deal, has not brought enough jobs to the district, has not been an effective representative as she should have been. That may play with some voters, but again, Moore has not been widely criticized by the mainstream left of center folks in Milwaukee.
And does this Democratic domination of this district go back quite a long ways?
Well, the district changed with various redistricting. You know, Milwaukee used to have two representatives. One was basically the north side of Milwaukee, and one was basically the south side. Now, Representative Moore, I believe, represents the whole city as well as a suburb or two. She's the main Democrat in Milwaukee, which has been pretty reliable for the Democratic Party in a number of different races over the last, going back to Tommy Thompson's time and really before that.
Is this a race that you expect to see a lot of turnout, especially on the primary day?
Well, that's the key, I think, is getting those supporters. If Gwen Moore has this network of supporters and is taking Gary George seriously, like her campaign says she does, then turnout will be a key, because in low turnout races, things can sometimes get surprising and upsets can occur. I'm not saying that's going to happen here, but I think Moore needs to make sure that her people get out to the polls, her supporters get out to the polls, just to make sure that perceived advantage that she has translates to reality on election day.
We've got statewide Democratic primaries for attorney general and for governor. While those are higher profile races, are those, given the matchups we see in the primaries, are those things that you think might drive turnover in that district?
Turnout.
Yeah.
Turnout. In the attorney general's race, certainly there's a lively Democratic primary. I don't know about in the governor's race, but in the attorney general, that will help turn out. Next week in Milwaukee, then early voting has certainly started here. Not as much early voting as previous years due to the Walker administration, but there's some early voting going on. But, what Gwen Moore, I think, would like to be doing is helping those Democratic candidates, especially in the governor's race, make introductions in Milwaukee and meet people here. But she's rather frustrated that she's having to run against former Senator George. But that's the way it is. And we'll see how active she is with the top-of-the-ticket Democrats if she wins the primary. If she doesn't win the primary, if Gary George wins and pulls an upset, then all bets are off in terms of how the 4th District would vote in November.
What are you going to be watching for as you're reporting this election between now and the primary election day?
Well, just sort of unexpected things or maybe suspected things, see if they materialize. Senator George, some think that he's being strongly backed by the school voucher movement. Will there be last-minute spending in favor of him or help at the doors and so on? On the Republican side, I don't know, probably the same sort of thing in terms of the last-minute unexpected charges. But again, I'm not sure the Republican side will be as close, and I'm not sure the Democratic side will be as close. But as I say, there's always sort of these last-minute possibilities that can crop up, especially in a relatively low turnout primary.
And then while we've got you, I want to look ahead a little bit to November. One of the big strategies, I guess maybe the big strategy in the race for governor, is to get your supporters to turn out and really concentrate on your high volume supporter districts for the Republicans. That tends to be that suburban belt around Milwaukee. Democrats, it tends to be Milwaukee. Are you expecting to see a whole lot of media action, a lot of campaigning in that part of the state?
Well, already is. Governor Walker was out in Waukesha yesterday encouraging about 75 volunteers to keep at the doors for me. He said complacency is his campaign's biggest soft spot, that people think, well, he won in 2010, he won in 2012, he ought to win in 2014, but that's not what the polls say necessarily. Polls say very close. Mary Burke's been over here, was at State Fair last week, was in Racine and Kenosha over the weekend. So there already been a lot of activity, and, it's not quite a sprint yet, but they picked up the pace, and I think after next Tuesday, things will really ramp up.
Chuck, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach. He's WPR's reporter in Milwaukee. In just a moment, we'll hear from one of the two Republican candidates in the race, Dan Sebring. And remember, all week here on Central Time and in the morning on the Joy Cardine Show, we're bringing you candidate forums in congressional primaries, the governor's race, and other statewide races, anywhere there's a contested primary. Today on the show, we're talking with the candidates in Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District. We met the Democratic candidates a little while ago. Republican David King was scheduled to join us but canceled due to family obligations. Now we turn to the other Republican, Dan Sebring. He is a Milwaukee business owner. He serves as the first vice chairman of the Republican Party of Milwaukee County. He joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, you ran a write-in campaign against Representative Moore in 2008 and then formal campaigns in 2010 and 2012. What keeps you coming back, challenging, trying to unseat incumbent Gwen Moore?
Well, I still see the opportunity to actually unseat Gwen Moore. The way that this all started back in 2008 was I wrote Representative Moore a letter, and it was her response to that letter that motivated me to run against her. My interpretation of her response to my letter to her was basically mind your own business. I'm a sitting congressman. I'm a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, and you're just a citizen, and I'll tell you what's good for you, and you should just do what I tell you. And I could not wait to vote against her in the primary election in 2008, and that's when I found that she was unopposed. And just as for something to do in protest, I wrote my name in on the ballot where it said write-in. And when I got back to my place of business, people knew that I had gone to vote. And I told them that I had to write in my own name because Gwen Moore was running unopposed. And that's when Scott Walker's father-in-law, who's a customer of mine, turned around and looked at me and says, you know, you could actually run for Congress. You would make a good congressman. And we Googled how to do it. And by the end of the day, I was a registered write-in candidate in 2008. And we had a six-week write-in campaign that next to nobody knew about. And I still managed to get 437 votes, if my memory serves me correctly. That told me that I was onto something, and I got my name on the ballot for the 2010 election.
Well, can you tell us a little more about your background and how it would serve you in Congress?
Well, I'm a United States Navy veteran, and I served on the Chief of Naval Operations Intelligence Staff at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration. I have a pretty good idea of how things work in Washington and what it takes to actually get things done.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing your district, the 4th Congressional District, the Milwaukee area, and what would you do to tackle those?
Well, obviously, the biggest problem that we have is jobs. You know, people want to get back to work. And there's a number of things that we can do that can address that problem. I personally would like to see the entire 4th Congressional District designated a federal enterprise zone where we could provide tax incentives to businesses that come to Milwaukee, that come to the 4th District, that hire people from the 4th District, provide job training for people in the 4th District. And one of the things that has to go hand in hand with that is education. We have an undereducated workforce. So we need to expand school choice and bolster our public school system and find out what the problem is there, that we have so many people that aren't graduating getting very poor grades, and we need to provide an educated workforce for businesses to come to Milwaukee and put those people to work.
And then turning away from things directly in the district, looking at the national scene, what do you see as a big challenge facing the United States?
Boy, there's so much going on, isn't there? But I think the number one thing that we need to do is secure that southern border. We have to stem the flow of the illegal immigrants that are coming across that border. And then once we've taken care of that, then we need to decide what to do with those people that are already here. That's, I think, the number one thing other than jobs and the economy.
What would you see as the right strategy to try to stem that flow?
Well, like I said, the first thing we need to do is secure the border. If that means sending the National Guard to the border, then that means sending the National Guard to the border until we can, if we need to build a fence or put in ground centers, if we can keep people out of Area 51, we can keep people from crossing that southern border. So that's got to be number one on the list.
That was a big issue in this last session of Congress just ended. We came out with nothing, effectively leaving it to the president to try to sort out, representative of a lot of the gridlock we see in Congress. How do you overcome that, assuming that, you know, maybe you're in a Republican House and there's still a Democratic Senate and president?
Well, that is an issue, isn't it? Because the gridlock is coming in on the Senate side. People forget that Congress is made up of the two houses. There's the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. And the House of Representatives has passed hundreds of bills that are sitting on Harry Reid's desk collecting dust. And meanwhile, we have Democrats decrying the Republicans as the do-nothing, as the obstructionists, when in fact it's Harry Reid.
Well, aren't there policies that have passed the Democratic Senate that are sitting on the floor in the House?
That could very well be true.
So how did you set yourself apart from your primary opponent, David King?
Well, like I mentioned before, I'm a United States Navy veteran. I served on the Chief of Naval Operations Intelligence Staff at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration. I know how things go in Washington. I've lived and worked there. I own my own business. I've been in business for 21 years. I am the first vice chairman of the Republican Party of Milwaukee County South Branch, and I've been an officer in the Republican Party of Milwaukee County for the past 6 years. I believe that I have infinitely better qualifications than my primary opponent.
Turning to some other issues that have been big in the House, the Affordable Care Act. There have been efforts from the House to repeal it. Didn't go anywhere. Again, Democratic Senate, Democratic president. Looking at the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as some have called it, Are there parts of it you think we should keep? Would you like to see some of it stay, change others, or repeal the whole thing?
Well, I support the American Health Care Reform Act, which is something that actually does keep a few of the elements of Obamacare, but at the same time, it actually repeals Obamacare. In my opinion, Obamacare is too broken. It can't be fixed. We need to throw it out and start over again. And some of the things that the American Health Care Reform Act keeps is the pre-existing conditions aspect of Obamacare would be included in that Health Care Reform Act, as well as the 26-year-old staying on their parents' policies.
Now, there's been recent news, the U.S. House moving toward a lawsuit against President Obama, in large part because of his implementation or delaying parts of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Talk from some, including some of your colleagues running to replace Tom Petri, of investigations of the president with an eye toward impeachment down the road. Where do you stand on lawsuits against the president or possible impeachment down the road?
Well, I am not aware of any Republican efforts to actually impeach the president. Now, we have this lawsuit that we're talking about now, and I believe that that's completely appropriate. I believe that the president has overstepped his authority in a lot of the executive orders that he's signed recently, and you know, I'm completely in favor of that being investigated and having the court render a decision as to whether or not he did or did not exceed his authority.
Where do you put priorities as far as foreign policy? We've talked lately on this show about a long list of foreign policy crises facing the United States. Where are you looking toward? Where should we have our eye on the ball around the world?
Oh, Israel. And absolutely, Israel. We need to support Israel.
Do you support the way that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, is trying to negotiate a settlement there in Gaza?
I don't believe that he's going about that the right way. We need to stand behind Israel and do pretty much what they think that we should do. It's their country. We shouldn't be telling them what to do, but we need to stand behind them. They haven't proposed anything completely outrageous, and I think we need to stand with Israel.
Now, sorry to get a little political wonky with you, but this district, the 4th District, has been viewed as a safe seat for Democrats for some time. You've been making the case in the media lately that you have a real shot this time around. Make the case that this is winnable for the Republicans.
Absolutely. You know, there are over 530,000 registered voters in the 4th Congressional District, and over the last four presidential elections, at some point, over 313,000 of those registered voters voted for a Republican. So there are people crossing the lines. I know that it's easy to say that it's a heavily Democrat district and you know how the district is rated by Cooks and such. But the fact of the matter is enough people have crossed the lines to vote for a Republican in the past that they will do it again.
And I wanted to get into a key part of your platform. You've talked a lot about the budget, deficit spending, and taxes. Can you outline your priorities there?
Well, we need to lower taxes, number one, and we need to reduce regulations as well. It's been shown over and over again that when you reduce taxes and reduce regulations, it actually increases the amount of money that comes into the government's coffers.
And have you seen areas of policy? You mentioned a couple parts of the Affordable Care Act you might be willing to keep around. Are there other areas where you look and say, okay, I agree with Democrats or disagree with Democrats in principle in a lot of areas. Here are some places for bipartisan cooperation where something can happen.
You know, I'm sure that there's things like that that exist, but nothing actually pops into my head immediately. But certainly at the end of the day, you know, we need to get things done. And you know, I'm perfectly willing to reach across the aisle to get done what needs to be done. But it has to be reasonable. I'm not going to just capitulate and do what the left wants me to do and not have them, you know, meet me in the middle. There has to be a give and take.
Before we're done, can you leave us with a final message for voters with just over a week until Election Day?
Well, I can't say this enough. I am the first vice chairman of the Republican Party of Milwaukee County. I'm a United States Navy veteran. I served on the Chief of Naval Operations Intelligence Staff at the Pentagon during the Reagan administration. I raised my hand and swore to uphold and defend our freedoms that we hold so dear back then, and I'm ready to do it again. I am a grassroots conservative, and I firmly believe that a Republican can win the 4th District.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dan Sebring. He's a small business owner, one of two Republican candidates on the ballot for Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District primary. That's the district centering around Milwaukee. In 2012, a national survey showed more than half of women and three-quarters of men in the United States believe a child sometimes needs a, quote, good hard spanking.
And it's legal for schools to paddle children in 19 states. Now, though, new research shows that spanking may have an actual effect on children's brain, decreasing the amount of gray matter they have, which is related to cognitive ability. Elizabeth Gershoff joins us now. She is an associate professor of human development and family sciences at the University of Texas at Austin and is an expert in the effects of spanking on children's development. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I want to start out with kind of the big question here. What do we know about how spanking actually alters kids' brains, and how do you find that out?
Well, so we've known for a long time that spanking is associated with children being more aggressive and having more mental health problems, and also that spanking is associated with less academic achievement and cognitive ability. So we've kind of known all these things for a while, but we didn't know exactly why. So why would spanking lead to those outcomes for children? And so now we have a hint of that from some of this research. And so several teams have been looking at actual changes in brain structure associated with spanking and have found that there are parts of the brain that are actually changed in children who are spanked compared with kids who are not, particularly for harsh corporal punishment, things like using an object and things like that, but also for milder forms as well. And so what appears it's happening is spanking is somehow changing, the experience of being spanked is changing the way children's brains function and actually how they are even formed. And that those changes are in parts of the brain that are associated with mental health problems like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. There's other research that's shown that when children are spanked, they have increases in stress hormone called cortisol. And so that over time, repeated high levels of that cortisol will also lead to changes in children's behavior and in their mental health.
So does this necessarily mean, as you look at this research, what percentage of kids who are affected by this actually experience that sort of change? Is this something that, you know, it's right across the board? You mentioned the seriousness of the punishment being handed out. That obviously has an effect on it, you say. But does it affect everybody in kind of the same way, or do we not have enough information on that?
That is a really good question, and I'm sure one that most parents around the country want to know the answer to. I think we're still in the very early stages of understanding this. So right now, this research has only been done on very small samples, because you can imagine doing these kind of brain scans are very intensive, and so they can't use very large samples. So we don't have a good sense of how this is working over the whole population. All we know is among the children who were in these studies, those who received kind of harsh corporal punishment were more likely to have these changes in brain structure than kids who didn't. It doesn't mean that every child will experience this. There might be some children in certain circumstances or with certain genetic predispositions that might be more susceptible to have these changes in their brains. We just don't know. We're still in very early stages.
Yeah, and taking that early stage into account, what are the implications of the thing as somebody who's been studying spanking and that sort of punishment for a long time? As you see this very, very preliminary information come in, what sorts of questions does it raise in your mind about how the brain is formed and what the impacts of it might be? Are we talking IQ here or some other mental health issues that you referenced earlier?
Well, I think the experience of being hit as a child, whether it's a discipline or whether it's physical abuse, are kind of the same. And so we have a large body of literature looking at the impacts of physical abuse on children, and it does change their brains, their mental health, their cognitive ability, children who are physically abused are, you know, understood by society to be at risk for a lot of problems. Spanking and other forms of corporal punishment we can see as kind of just a lesser version of that. It all involves hitting. It all involves the child being in pain, possibly in fear of their parents, and experiencing stress, the stress of being hit. And so all of those experiences are just at a lower level for children being spanked versus being abused. And so some of the things we know about physical abuse might apply. But again, we're still kind of in the early stages of understanding this.
Yeah, and in terms of the early stages of the brain, the impacts on the brain, but there are some other things that I'm pretty sure we know about the long-term behavioral effects on spanking. Some of the research you've done suggests that, you know, kids are actually become more rebellious instead of less when they're spanked, that sort of thing. What things do we actually know so far about some of these effects of spanking?
Well, we have very strong evidence that the more children are spanked, the more aggressive they are over time. And so we also know that they are more likely to get into trouble, so more likely to misbehave. They're more likely to be delinquent, to have mental health problems, both as children and as adults. And we also know, unfortunately, that when children are spanked, they're more likely to be also physically abused by their parents. So there's a real connection there between spanking and physical abuse. That does not mean that every child who is spanked will be abused, but there is a connection there. And so these findings have been replicated in hundreds of studies. So we're very confident in those findings. What this new research on the brain is telling us is that it's giving us a hint for why. It's not always clear why should being hit as a child have them turn out to be delinquent. It's not a direct line. Kids aren't spanked and then they don't run out and rob a store. There's something happening in their brain that's changing them, that's changing how they see, how they make decisions, how they evaluate options, how they empathize with other people, the emotions they feel when they are in a stressful situation. All of these things are happening in their brains when they're being spanked and affect how they behave in other situations. And so this new research is kind of showing us this is part of what's happening, is we're actually seeing changes in the brain that then lead to changes in children's behavior in other situations.
So what's next? You have to do more of this type of research, I imagine. But does this also suggest new avenues that you might want to pursue?
I think we definitely want more information about what's happening in children's brains and whether there is some kind of variation by amount of hitting, as you kind of suggested earlier. Most parents do not spank their kids very harshly. They don't use objects, but they do use their hand. And that is a painful experience for kids. And I think we need to understand more about what children are actually experiencing when they're being hit. We know that they cry, so we assume that they're in pain, but what else is happening in their brains? And it's hard to study that in vivo when it's actually happening. We can't put kids in an MRI machine and then spank them in there. Like, we can't do that. So it's kind of hard to really understand what's going on in the brain, but the closer we can get to doing that would be really helpful to understanding why spanking is having these effects on children.
Now, we opened, when we did the introduction to this, the numbers of people who think that it's okay to spank, in a very hard sort of fashion is still okay. And there are a lot of people, I think, who think spanking is just sort of this benign thing. You're telling me it's not. What should people like that make of this new research?
I think it should make all parents who spank think twice. It should make us think a little harder about it and maybe try other methods. I think that kids are small and they can't always vocalize what's going on in their brains and in their bodies. And so I think parents are not always aware how hard they're hitting their children and how much it hurts them and how afraid it makes them feel. And they can't see these long-term impacts that I can see in the research. And so I would encourage parents to think of trying other alternatives that don't involve hitting and hurting children. Because what we're learning now is it really is affecting them in ways that can't always be seen right in that moment.
And in the time that you've been doing research, have you seen a change in attitude, or has this been steady?
It's been fairly steady. It's been decreasing over the last 30 years or so, but still the majority of adults in America think it's still okay for parents to spank their children. And I think, you know, we're kind of out of step with the rest of the world. More than 30 countries have banned corporal punishment by parents. and have seen this research and have made decisions accordingly. And we're just not there yet. But I think it's time for us to really pay attention and learn from what we're getting from this research that, you know, even though this is a practice we've been doing for hundreds, if not thousands of years, it might be time to stop.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Gershoff is an associate professor of human development and family sciences at the University of Texas at Austin and an expert in the effects of spanking on children's development.
Time now for Wisconsin Life. Tomorrow marks the two-year anniversary of the tragic shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Shauna Singh Baldwin tells us about sharing her faith and her temple with a young friend.
In the 30 years I've lived in Milwaukee, two people have asked to visit a Sikh temple with me. In that time, I've attended many services at churches and synagogues. But since a neo-Nazi walked into our temple in Oak Creek and shot six people in cold blood before turning his gun on himself, Wisconsin Sikhs have been urged by our leaders to reach out to people of other faiths. So when an old friend's 19-year-old daughter asked to visit my temple to fulfill a school requirement, I was welcoming, but wary. As Bella and I drove past a tan lakeshore, I explained that 22 million Sikhs worldwide respect the teachings of a lineage of 10 gurus, beginning with Guru Nanak, born in 1469. The Guru Granth Sahib, a book filled with the Guru's poems of praise to a faceless, impersonal God, is a person for us. The 1430-page book is ceremoniously woken each morning, dressed, read from as worship, and put to bed at night. The five gold domes are new, I told Bella as we pulled into the parking lot. They're dedicated to those shot down by the Aryan supremacist. Inside, we took off our shoes and I covered her head with her favorite of my long, sparkly chunni scarves. We walked up the center aisle to the holy book, dressed today in glittering embroidered vestments of pink, purple, and gold. We touched our foreheads to the ground before it and took our seats among other brightly dressed women across from a sea of men's colorful turbans and kerchiefs. A few Orthodox women bowed their turbans. Most of the women had long braids or buns. Very few, like me, had shorn hair beneath their bright veils. I wish I had explained to her that Sikhism may be the only religion in the world that preaches equality between men and women. I wished I'd told her that any woman present was allowed to read from the Guru, officiate during worship, and volunteer for leadership. I hoped she'd read it online. Poems in archaic Punjabi filled the hall, chanted and sung by three turbaned men to the pumping of a harmonium and the patter of the tabla. Bella and I read English translations projected on the walls behind the dais. "It's a lot to take in," Bella whispered. Though I've known Bella since she was born, our visit to the temple showed her a side of me she has never seen. For me, it was strange to see my faith through the eyes of a non-believer and have to explain it, both historically and theologically. Both of us were changed by our Sunday together. Thanks to Bella's respectful and curious visit, I'm more open to guiding other visitors to the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. My God is your God. It's only ignorance that separates us.
Shauna Singh Baldwin is the award-winning author of several novels, including The Selector of Souls.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Shauna Singh Baldwin joins us now to talk about the path forward since the shooting. Shauna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I want to start with going back 2 years, and I read an interview with you where you went to the temple right after the shooting, and one of the things that sort of surprised you at the time or that you observed was you realized that other people at the temple weren't necessarily particularly surprised by all of this, by the shooting, by the violence that happened. Can you take us back to that and tell me why that would be?
Well, ever since 9/11, there have been attacks on turbaned Sikh men and hate crimes against Sikhs right after 9/11, the initial theory was that these were cases of mistaken identity where they felt that they were going after Muslims. And, of course, we were concerned that they shouldn't go after anybody, you know, whether it was Sikhs or Muslims. So there was a very fine line for us because we didn't want to redirect the violence to Muslims, but we were very concerned. And so the Sikh coalition was formed around that time, and attacks on Sikhs have been a constant irritant since then, some very violent ones. In fact, last Tuesday, there was a man in New York who shouted racial epithets at a Sikh man and then ran him over with his truck and drove away, and the guy is still in hospital. So this is continuing since 9/11, and our community has not been surprised. But what was a shock was that this incident, this tragedy, was a planned attack. The man came in, cased the joint and everything, and then he had to come in through a very long driveway across the parking lot and with a semi-automatic gun. And really, it's not something that just was spur of the moment.
Now, at the time, you wrote about how the Sikh religion was called obscure in the papers, and how people really didn't seem to know who you were, what you were about. In the years that have passed, has any of that changed? Do you see any progress in people either understanding or at the very least trying to understand?
Oh, I think that, you know, there have been so many efforts to help this, I mean, to address this. The authorities have been just amazing in Oak Creek, the federal authorities, the U.S. attorney, the mayor of Oak Creek, and so many people who have reached out to us since the shooting. So the people who are actually on the ground in Oak Creek have certainly reached out to us in very heartwarming ways. But other Americans don't know that we've been on this continent since the 1900s, or that there are 22 million Sikhs worldwide. And we aren't evangelical either. Most of us believe that our faith is, you know, between you and your creator kind of thing. So, I think there's a mixed response on that one. The people in banks and drugstores around the temple, they've all made such a huge effort to reach out to Sikhs around them and just say, hey, we're not like that perpetrator. But last weekend, I and what seemed like 1,000 other American Sikh and non-Sikh went on a 6-kilometer walk, 1 kilometer for each victim. And, you know, through the 1950s-style ranch homes of Oak Creek, and we have a reputation for being active and entrepreneurial and argumentative and ambitious and tech-savvy, and all those traits were needed to organize this walk. So, and, you know, my work as a writer is pretty solitary, and I was surprised how good it felt to be with Sikhs and non-Sikhs who were commemorating the tragedy. So in that sense, yes, there has been some change.
And when there is an anniversary like this, of course, there's often a flurry of activity around that. But I'm curious as to whether you see a more tangible progress, not just necessarily in the, you know, the community members that surround the temple in Oak Creek, but maybe in the population at large, that there is an understanding there that, you know, that the temple is a place where tragedies like this shouldn't happen, and that people should have some tolerance. Do you see that sort of thing happening on a larger scale, or just sort of in the bits and pieces that affect your life more directly?
Well, I'll tell you, we're still dealing with this. I think that there's so many people who are still indirectly affected by this tragedy. I mean, two young women who came for their father's funeral happened to be pregnant at the time. And a Sikh volunteer social worker, Nimi Arora, helped them, you know, through their pregnancies. A couple of the victims' wives had never worked outside the home and suddenly found themselves thrust into the role of breadwinner. you know, in a foreign country where few people speak Punjabi or Hindi, and they've had to adjust. So we're still adjusting to this whole thing. One of the wives of the victims was denied a visa to return to the U.S. because Homeland Security said her status was dependent on her husband's visa. So, you know, they're still dealing with this, and pro bono attorneys have been involved to try to get her to return to her children over here. There's been non-Sikhs who've been affected by it. You know, a woman who lived near the temple had panic attacks for several months after the shooting because the police had occupied her home as they searched for the perpetrator. So I don't think that we're at that point yet where we can say that the larger community knows much about us or anything, because we're still dealing with the aftermath of this tragedy. I mean, just to give you an idea, we have become the target of places like the Westboro Baptist Church, and this church is counseling its followers on its site to take advantage of the shooting to proselytize to Sikhs. So I wonder if they thought that's what Jesus would do. But, this is ongoing, and we have to counter it with education. And we're trying to do that, I guess.
We've only got about a minute left, and so I apologize for that. But what do you want to leave people with as you think about this anniversary and you think about the sort of the destructive power of ignorance and hatred?
Well, you know, being a writer, I believe language shapes and changes our thinking. So what if we, you know, Sikhs and non-Sikhs, enlarged the definition of the word family to include many more in the term? You heard me say our God is your God, and we may look different and speak a few more languages than English, but we're still part of the human family. And we could also enlarge our definition of words like minority and diversity, which are just too often used as code words for black. Several minorities live in this country, and people of many shades of brown and black. All residents of this country have the right to religious freedom, not only those of the Abrahamic traditions. And the perpetrator showed us that he had the power to destroy, and how very easy it is to destroy, so easy that you can destroy yourself as well. But what that also means is that one person has the power to create, to mend and amend. And I just want to leave you with this one, that the good luck greeting of the Sikhs is Chardi Kala, meaning spiritual progress through the arts. And art and humor just can offer a way in, an alternative to Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Mark Belling, and Charlie Spence.
And I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Shauna, thanks so much for joining us. That was Shauna Singh Baldwin, the author of What the Body Remembers and We Are Not Pakistan. Her latest book is The Selector of Souls.